From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Israeli tourism minister is in the United States to lobby against the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Who will he be talking to? Leaders of Congress and Christian fundamentalists close to the president. He believes Christians will launch a crusade to put an end to Islam. And the new U.S. TV station in occupied Iraq is being run by fundamentalist Christians. We'll hear a report. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. officials gave the first details yesterday of their plan to set up an interim Iraqi government. It will likely be headed by a council of as many as 9 leaders, the majority of whom would be drawn from U.S.-backed Iraqi exile groups that have yet to demonstrate popular support in Iraq. The head administrator of U.S.-occupied Iraq, retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner, said the nucleus of the interim Iraqi government would emerge by the end of the month. Garner named 5 figures who've already begun meeting. All were Kurdish or exile leaders who have long been backed and financed by the United States. They are Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress, Masoud Barzani of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, Jalal Talabani of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, Abdulaziz Hakim of the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and Ayad Alawi of the Iraqi National Accord. The Washington Post reports Garner visited Basra for the first time. After he met with hospital officials, an Iraqi man trailed him, carrying a small boy about 5 years old with both legs in casts. Blood seeped from the foot of one cast as the man tried to attract General Garner's attention. Garner, surrounded by bodyguards and aides, shook hands with the hospital director and, without appearing to notice the man, left to visit an oil refinery. The UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency, the IAEA, is urging Washington to allow it to investigate nuclear sites in Iraq that have reportedly been looted, but Washington has ignored the requests. The agency is concerned that radioactive material, known to be stored at several Iraqi sites, could pose health and environmental risks. There are also fears they could be used to create a so-called dirty bomb. Over the weekend, the Washington Post and New York Times ran articles indicating the U.S. had taken few measures to secure former nuclear sites. The Post reported the Baghdad nuclear research facility, Iraqis had been, quote, coming in by the scores over the last 2 weeks. Radioactive material is scattered around the site. The U.S. is saying it has captured Dr. Huda Salimadi Amash, one of Saddam Hussein's most senior biological weapons scientists. She's the number 53 on the U.S. list of 55 most wanted Iraqi leaders, one of the few women in Saddam Hussein's inner circle. This news from Gaza. The parents of a British peace activist who was shot in the head by Israeli troops came under fire themselves as they traveled to the spot where their son was critically injured. The London Independent reports Anthony and Jocelyn Herndl were in a British diplomatic convoy entering the town of Rafah in the Gaza Strip when Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint fired a shot which passed narrowly over the top of their vehicles. The Herndl's eldest son, Tom, is in a coma in an Israeli hospital after he was shot 3 weeks ago while trying to reach 2 Palestinian children. The U.S. military is preparing to release about 15 prisoners from the U.S. Navy prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This includes as many as 3 boys aged between 13 and 16 years old who were captured in Afghanistan that have been at Guantanamo for more than a year. The Washington Post reports the Pentagon plans to expedite decisions about whether to prosecute, continue interrogating, or release more than 660 detainees held at the detention facility. This comes after criticism from Secretary of State General Colin Powell. A mission by three Southern African leaders aimed at resolving the political crisis in Zimbabwe by securing the departure of President Robert Mugabe ended in dismal failure yesterday. This, according to a report in the London Independent. South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki, the Nigerian leader President Obasanjo, and the Malawian President Bakili Mazuli jetted into Harare yesterday for meetings with President Mugabe in the hope that this would lead to a deal for the 79-year-old Mugabe's retirement and the installation of a new president from Mugabe's ZANU-PF party. The talks also included a representative from an opposition party that is challenging Zimbabwe's last election. Mugabe rejected any talks of stepping down until the opposition drops its lawsuit and recognizes him as Zimbabwe's official leader. University of California, Berkeley will turn away new students from SARS-infected China, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong this summer in what is believed to be the first such move by a major U.S. university to stop the spread of the virus. Meanwhile, in China, 10,000 people have been quarantined in the eastern city of Nanjing in a bid to contain SARS. In China, SARS has killed 214 people and infected more than 4,400 others. Newly released transcripts indicate that Senator Joseph McCarthy used closed-door sessions to winnow out witnesses who might have challenged him in the sensational anti-communism hearings 50 years ago. Of the 500 witnesses who testified in private, one-third were never called back to testify in public. Senate Associate Historian Donald Ritchie said, quote, "Anybody who stood up to McCarthy in closed session and did so articulately tended not to get called up in public session. McCarthy was only interested in the people he could browbeat publicly." McCarthy was a Wisconsin Republican who led the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in 1953 and 1954 at the heart of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. His investigation into communists and the U.S. government was widely seen as a witch hunt and spawned the term McCarthyism to describe smear attacks. In the New York Times today, it says Aaron Copland, the composer, fiercely defended himself, declaring, "I have not been a communist in the past, and I am not now a communist." Langston Hughes, the poet, protested that he had not read much about Marxism, quote, "beyond the introduction of the Communist Manifesto." And Dashiell Hammett, the mystery writer, invoked the Fifth Amendment, among nearly 500 others who were summoned to testify in secret before Senator Joseph McCarthy's committee. Congress may soon pass a controversial new law that would shield gun manufacturers and dealers from lawsuits filed by victims of gun crimes. The bill has been the focus of a major lobbying push by the NRA and a lesser-known organization called the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which has raised $100 million over the past 5 years from gun makers to fight lawsuits and fund its national political campaign. A recent article in the Washington Post quotes a top aide to a Senate Democrat who calls the bill "Things You've Got to Do to Get Reelected Act." A Colombian provincial governor, a former defense minister, and eight military personnel were killed in a failed rescue attempt near the northern Colombian town of Oral on Monday. They were among the 80 hostages that the FARC have been using to negotiate for the release of political prisoners. The Colombian government immediately blamed the rebels for the murders, which were described as execution-style killings. But a FARC spokesperson read a communique on local radio blaming the deaths on a botched rescue attempt by government forces. In the Philippines, the government has called off talks with the main Muslim separatist group, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. This comes 2 days after about 30 people died in an attack by the group on Sunday. And a veteran of South Africa's anti-apartheid movement died last night. Walter Sisulu was 90 years old. Sisulu spent a quarter of a century in jail alongside his close friend, Nelson Mandela. They were both sentenced to life in prison for plotting sabotage and revolution and detained on Robben Island until the apartheid regime finally relented and released him in 1989. Sisulu was elected deputy president of the African National Congress in 1991. This was a position he held until after South Africa's first democratic election in 1994. Mandela said in a statement, quote, "His absence has carved a void. A part of me is gone. Together we shared ideas, forged common commitments. We walked side by side through the valley of death, nursing each other's bruises, holding each other up when our steps faltered. Together we savored the taste of freedom." And you are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian and Israeli extremists are doing everything they can to sabotage the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Palestinian gunmen last night shot dead an Israeli settler and wounded two others in the West Bank. The attack came just hours after U.S. envoy William Burns met with recently installed Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. Burns told Abbas and other senior Palestinian officials they must make every effort to stop attacks on Israelis. Burns said this is necessary to ensure progress on the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Meanwhile, Israeli tourism minister Benny Elon has arrived in the United States to lobby Congress and Christian fundamentalists against the roadmap. Elon is scheduled to hold a news conference tomorrow in which he will present a plan of his own. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Elon's plan will call for the establishment of a Palestinian state, but not in the occupied territories. He will say the Palestinians should establish their country in Jordan. Elon is said in a statement, quote, "Our stay in Judea and Samaria is not temporary. Judea and Samaria are ancient Jewish names for the occupied West Bank." Elon is planning to lobby prominent Christian fundamentalists close to President Bush. An Israeli government spokesperson told the Agence France-Presse these religious leaders include Christian Coalition President Roberta Combs, former presidential candidate Gary Bauer, and Pat Robertson, founder of the Christian Broadcasting Network, who once said, "God gave the land to the descendants of Israel. It was not given to Palestine." The Haaretz newspaper reports Elon said, quote, "What we are now seeing across the Muslim world is not a powerful surge of faith, but the dying embers of Islam. How will it disappear? Very simply. Within a few years, a Christian crusade against Islam will be launched, which will be the major event of this millennium." The tourism minister goes on to say, "Obviously, we'll be up against quite a large problem when only the two great religions of Judaism and Christianity remain, but that's still a long way off." We're going to start with Danielle Ben-Simon, who is a journalist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, who wrote the piece that quoted the tourism minister. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Can you talk more about who the tourism minister is and more about what he said, this very blatant quote that says within a few years a Christian crusade against Islam will be launched?
Well, Mr. Elon is one of the first settlers in the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, the way he calls them. He is an Israeli fundamentalist and really believes that the land of Israel was given by God to the Jews not the Israelis, but the Jews. And I would say that Mr. Elon represents the extreme right wing of in Israeli politics, and he is a member of Prime Minister Sharon's coalition. Not only that, he is the Minister of Tourism, so he is in touch with the international community, and he is now busy doing marketing for his peace plan, which is totally against Mr. Sharon's peace plan. For Mr. Benny Elon, the West Bank, as you said, belongs to the Jews, and the only place for Palestinians is in Jordan. So it's an old-fashioned view, but now revived and resuscitated by Mr. Elon. And I must say that it is doing it's not doing a good service to Mr. Sharon and his peace plan, and of course the American envoys in the Middle East.
Can you talk more about his relationship with Sharon, who you say he says suffers from a kind of founder's syndrome, and then why Sharon would allow him to come to the United States to lobby this plan supposedly opposed to Sharon's, or to the plan that Sharon's supposed to be supporting to get U.S.
Yes.
support?
Yes, I must agree with the essence of your question. I wonder why Mr. Sharon is allowing Mr. Elon to market a peace plan which runs counter the government peace plan and the roadmap. And I must maybe come to a conclusion that maybe deep in his heart, Mr. Sharon does not disagree with Mr. Elon. And otherwise, he would have called him back to Israel and maybe try to discipline him. But the fact that Mr. Elon, a member of the Israeli government, is trying to market a peace plan against the Israeli peace plan, raises a few questions. And I must say that about the Christian fundamentalists, we have now a new alliance between the Israeli the Jewish fundamentalist and the Christian fundamentalist as to the land of Israel. And it's never been so close like today when the American administration is trying to put an end to this bloodshed in the area. Suddenly you have a Christian alliance with the Jewish fundamentalists trying to torpedo this American initiative in the Middle East, and I can't tell you more than that. I don't know exactly what are the Christian fundamentalist motivations in trying to stop a peace plan. It seems to me that Israelis and Palestinians are now getting ready to do something in order to stop the bloodshed, and Benny Elon is in the United States in order to really to call for Christian fundamentalists to kill the roadmap, which he sees as a dangerous thing to Israel.
It's quite something what you write. You quote Elon as saying, "It's clear Islam is on the way to disappearing." And then you write, "Until then, the roadmap is stuck in Elon's throat like a bone." Like his settler colleagues, he too suspected Sharon's intentions from the beginning. His apprehension only increased in the wake of Sharon's interview with Haaretz last month, in which he ceded Beit El, Shiloh, Bethlehem, Elon, a resident of Beit El. Oh, and Elon comes from Beit El, one of the settlements. And he says,
That's
quote,
right.
I
That's
felt
right.
a terrible pain. I even cried, he relates. I told the others that we will fight Sharon with all our might. He should know that we will cut ourselves off from him long before Israel cuts itself off from Beit El. And says that Sharon suffers from a founder syndrome. He refers to people who established the state and fought for it, but were seized by weakness in their old age.
You know, talking about, he's got a point, Mr. Elon, as about the founder's syndrome. I must say, it's almost a tragedy in Israel that leaders try to make peace when they reach their 70s and their 80s. That's exactly what happened with the Prime Minister Menachem Begin when he made peace with Egypt, and with Prime Minister Rabin when he made peace with the Palestinians. He was already in his mid-70s, and now Sharon, in his mid-70s, is trying really to make peace with the Palestinians. So I must say, maybe there's something in this founder's syndrome that and almost when they're reaching the end of their life, they're trying really to do something in order to make peace. And Mr. Elon is, as he said in the interview, he's really very worried about signs of peace that in Sharon's behavior. And unless Sharon is determined to go with this peace plan, Mr. Elon might win with the American Christian Coalition, because as I understand, they are very close to President Bush and to this Republican administration, and they might succeed in really killing the roadmap before it become it is applied in the West Bank.
Daniel Bell-Simon, I'd like you to stay on the line. We are going to a break, and then we're going to talk about the relationship between the Israeli government and Christian fundamentalists in the United States, why the tourism minister is coming here not only to lobby members of Congress, but to go through the Bible Belt. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Before we go on talking about the relationship between the Christian right in this country and the government of the State of Israel, I wanted to ask Danielle Ben-Simon, journalist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, who has written about the Israeli tourism minister's trip to the United States, about the response of settlers to the so-called roadmap to peace.
Yes. Well, I must say that for the settlers, the roadmap is a death sentence, because it calls for the freeze of the settlements and eventually for the dismantling of most of the settlements. So for the settlers, the roadmap is the end of life. And that's why they are fighting, and they're going to fight against Sharon in order to kill this plan, because the way they see it, a freeze of the settlements is a death sentence which will lead to the dismantlement of the settlements. And I must say that for them, as you mentioned earlier, it's a biblical land given from God to the Jews, and nobody, no official government, no democracy can really do something against the word of God. So it's not just a political problem. It is a religious, a fundamentalist problem. And I must say that we might see really a real war. But if the Israeli government endorses the roadmap, we might see the settlers fighting for their life. Because, as I said, the roadmap is perceived by them as a death sentence.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Danielle Ben-Simon, for joining us, journalist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, as we move on to talk about the relationship between the Christian right and the Israeli government. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the Israeli tourism minister coming to the United States today to lobby not only presidential aides, members of Congress, but also members of the Christian right, the Christian Coalition President Roberta Combs, a former presidential candidate Gary Bauer, and Pat Robertson, founder of the Christian Broadcasting Network. We're joined on the line by John Grebe, who has written a piece for Counterpunch. You can see it at counterpunch.org, called Reverend Pat Robertson in the temple, channeling the word to the infidels. John Grebe also is a producer on Boston community radio station WZBC. And a shout out to all the folks at ZBC, broadcasting Democracy Now! Every day at noon. Can you talk about your piece, John, about Pat Robertson and the State of Israel?
Hi, Amy. It's good to be on the program. Reverend Dr. Pat Robertson, as he's called, visited the Temple Beth Shalom in Framingham, Massachusetts, on the Sunday before Passover. He was invited to this Jewish synagogue to speak by some of the congregants. And interestingly enough, the rabbi, Gary Green, of that synagogue, describes his congregation as politically liberal.
John, do you have a radio on or something that you could turn off?
No, there's no radio on. Is there a problem with the phone?
No, it's a little better. Thanks. There's just a little bit of reverberation on your voice. Feedback.
Okay.
Go ahead.
As I was saying, Reverend Pat Robertson came to speak in the synagogue, and he spoke in a way, I think, that disturbed a lot of the Jewish congregation in the synagogue, as far as I could notice. And there was a group in particular there, Jews Saying No to the Christian Right, who objected to Reverend Pat Robertson's extremely conservative evangelical Christian politics, but wanted to support his support for the United States' $3 billion of aid every year to the government and military of Israel.
We're also joined on the line by one of the people who came to the Pat Robertson event at Temple Beth Shalom in Framingham, Massachusetts, Marty Fetterman, with the group Jews Saying No to the Christian Right. Can you talk about the event and what you did?
Hi.
It's good to have you with us.
It's nice to be here. We created our group specifically because of Reverend Robertson's extreme right-wing views on a variety of subjects. Most of us there disagree strongly with his views on Israel and this kind of coalition that's growing between the right wing of the institutional Jewish community and the far right fundamentalist evangelical Christian right. But we were motivated by a broader kind of issue, which has to do with the historical disagreement between mainstream Jewish community and, I would say, ancient Jewish values, and virtually all of the rest of Robertson's agenda. The institutional Jewish community has been in the forefront historically of working against the kinds of views that he expresses on church-state relations, other religions, including other Christian religions, homosexuality, women's rights, family values, all of those things. And we felt very strongly that while we certainly didn't argue with the synagogue's right to invite him, that it's really very strongly not in the Jewish community's interest to have this kind of relationship with the far Christian right. It's interesting that groups like the Anti-Defamation League, which has published some years ago one of the best books on the Christian right and exposing the differences that we have, has now taken to publishing ads of people from the Christian right because of this very narrow and, I think, ultimately very self-defeating kind of support for this one issue about the far-right Israeli position that you were just talking to Daniel Ben-Simon about.
So can you talk about exactly what happened to you? Why did police come into the temple?
Well, we don't fully know. We know that the synagogue, as is normal for large events and certainly anything that has to do with Israel, arranged for this police detail While I have tried to contact Rabbi Green, he has not returned my calls, but he has said to a number of reporters that they got this detail in order to keep general peace, but did not ask them to chase away demonstrators or to arrest anyone or anything like that. We were really quite surprised when we got there. There were about 15 of us who planned to be there, hand out leaflets, give a short press conference. And when we got there, were very, very aggressively chased off the synagogue property by the police detail. One policeman in particular was very hostile and aggressive. We were not able to leaflet, although we held signs and did hold the press conference and gave a statement about why we were there. And at which point, those of us who had tickets went in, listened to Reverend Robertson, passed up in some questions, which were very controlled. There were parameters as what could and couldn't be asked, and questions went in by cards. There was no interaction at that point, and two of us left right after the question and answer period and went outside in the parking lot and were beginning to hand out our leaflets, which basically contained primarily quotes from Pat Robertson himself about a variety of issues. Suddenly, this police officer came out and told us we were trespassing, we had to leave. We expressed our feelings that we weren't doing anything illegal, but said that we would leave. We had decided beforehand that this was an educational, informational demonstration, and that we would not ourselves get involved in anything confrontational. But despite that, there was a tremendous amount of hostility, and we were yelled at, and were on our way out to go again just off the property, and this officer obviously didn't like me and was intent on doing something, and I was subsequently arrested for trespassing and disorderly conduct.
Marty Fetterman on the line with us, arrested Temple Beth Shalom in Framingham, Massachusetts, protesting Pat Robertson's presence at the synagogue. We're also joined on the line by Professor Elaine Hagopian, who is a professor emeritus of sociology at Simmons College in Boston and host of Arabic Community Television in Boston. This quote that appeared in Haaretz of the tourism minister who's come to lobby against the peace plan in Washington, Elaine's comment, "It's clear Islam is on the way to disappear. Within a few years, a Christian crusade against Islam will be launched, which will be the major event of this millennium." Your response and the whole discussion of the Christian right now being courted by the State of Israel?
Well, first of all, I think that idea by alone is very wrong. I mean, Islam is not going to disappear. The only thing right about it, correct about it, is that there is already being launched a Christian fundamentalist crusade. As you know, Billy Graham's son is supposed to be leading a quote-unquote humanitarian group to Iraq, and that they expect that they will begin some actions there. The new program that the U.S. has launched for Iraq is also run by a Christian fundamentalist organization. So they're now trying to convert Iraq, where already the supposed exile leaders say they will recognize Israel and that they will work with Israel. Now they're actually trying to convert the people. I think there's going to be a terrible reaction to all of this. But I think, Amy, we should go back even to 1978, when the Christian right, encouraged both by the right-wing Falange group, which happened to be predominantly Maronite right-wing, And the Israelis who operated in southern Lebanon even as early as 1978 had a radio program in southern Lebanon preaching the same kind of Christian fundamentalism. One can talk about Netanyahu during the period when he was prime minister, when he was upset with Clinton, and Clinton was not crazy about Netanyahu. He would come and speak to the Christian fundamentalists first to demonstrate to Clinton that he could go over his head, that they had a strong group support that he would not be able to overcome. So I think that this is something very serious that we need to look at. But as far as Islam disappearing, I think that's not only a mistake, and if they use the word crusade, that's when you're going to rally an awful lot of Muslim countries and people to really be upset. As it is, they are already upset with us.
We're also joined on the line right now by Russell McIver, who is the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. And he has published a column along with Rob Weissman, editor of the Multinational Monitor, talking about the U.S. government launching its Arabic language satellite TV news station for Iraq. Iraq is overwhelmingly a Muslim country, but according to McIver and Weissman, the newest TV station is being produced by a studio which is controlled by fundamentalist Christians who are also extremely pro-Israel. The studio, Grace Digital Media, also runs Grace News Network, which claims to be, quote, dedicated to transmitting the evidence of God's presence in the world today. The U.S. agency Broadcasting Board of Governors has defended the selection of Grace Digital, which they claim will have nothing to do with the editorial side of the news broadcast. Russell, can you talk more about this company that's been hired to produce the news for Iraq?
Good morning, Amy. Yes. Well, it starts with a company called Federal News Service, and most newsies here in Washington understand, know about this company. It's a company that goes around to press conferences and congressional hearings, and they tape record the events and bring them back and immediately transcribe them and transmit them to subscribers, primarily law firms, trade associations, people who can afford it, who pay big money to get immediate transcripts. And this company was built by a gentleman named Cordis Randall, who's born-again Christian, and he, a couple years ago, invited Cheryl Reagan, who's another born-again Christian multimillionaire from Arkansas, to one of his prayer meetings. And they got together, and she became an investor in his company, and he says she forced him out of his own company that he built over the years. So she has control of Federal News Service, which is his major transcription company here in Washington. And she also started, before coming to Federal News, something called Grace News Network, which, alarmingly, I think, says that it not only will be reporting secular news, but will report aggressive proclamations that will change the news to reflect the kingdom of God and its purposes. Now, she came to control a TV production studio, and the Broadcasting Board of Governors chose, which BBG sees themselves as the BBC of the United States, broadcasting sort of non-propaganda news. They control Voice of America, Radio Sawa, which is the Arabic language radio that's very popular in the Arab world. And so they want BBG, the BBC of the United States, wants to produce a Arabic language satellite competitor to Al Jazeera, and they're starting by doing this news broadcast to Iraq, which started last week, and they run the U.S. evening news shows dubbed in Arabic. So they run ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox. I think CNN declined to go along with this. And then they run 3 hours of their own news programming. And they chose Grace Digital Media to produce this show. We also found out that that Grace News Network held a press conference here in the National Press Building last fall, in which they released a film called Israel: Divine Destiny, which is about, according to the website, Israel's destiny and the United States' role in that destiny. Although Thorne Ochter, who's the current CEO of Grace News Network, refused to show us a copy of the film, although they exist, and refused to get us a transcript. Thorne Ochter, by the way, some of your listeners might remember, is the former head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration under Bush 1 and President Reagan, and was responsible for dismantling many of the worker safety protections under law in the United States.
John Grebe, you have written about Pat Robertson, not only about the relationship with the State of Israel, but also about Pat Robertson's broadcasting network. And I'm wondering if you're drawing any links or associations here.
Absolutely. Pat Robertson's helped to found the Christian Broadcasting Network. And incidentally, he sold an earlier a version of his network for over $1 billion, that's billion with a B, several years ago. So this is no small operation. He actually bragged at the synagogue in Framingham last month that the 1967 Six Days War was brilliant, and then he described when he went in 1982 to broadcast in Israel and in Lebanon, he wanted to bring his Christian message to the Lebanese. And he claims that the Lebanese in 1982 shot rockets to knock out his television transmitter repeater link to Beirut, Lebanon. He said that his competitor's television station was showing worldwide wrestling competition to over 1 million viewers. And then he said somebody sent them a tape of female mud wrestling. I'm not kidding. Those were his words. And he said somehow his Christian station broadcast it to the Lebanese. He said that's kind of chuckling. He said that they loved it, although more rockets knocked out that mud wrestling when the television repeater link was attacked. I think it's also interesting to note that Pat Robertson said clearly in the synagogue in April, he said, why not begin educating the Arabs? Take their TV and cut down their propaganda. So I think to look at Pat Robertson's business designs, and particularly in light of what Russell Mokyber just said about this other business competitor and investor with the Federal News Service and now with the Grace News Network, I think we're seeing some kind of a business competition among these Christian broadcasters. I should just note, too, that another thing Pat Robertson said at this Jewish synagogue last month was that Wolfowitz and Cheney and Bush understand the spiritual significance. And that was said in the context of how he believes Ariel Sharon, known as the bulldozer, is strong. It makes me wonder about what Republican planners are desiring for the many politically liberal Jewish people here in the United States who often vote for Democrats. Republican planners may be looking at those potential Jewish votes and campaign dollars of the reflexively pro-Israeli Jewish Americans, not all Jewish Americans, but wondering if they might work out some kind of a bargain in order to attract those votes to the Republican Party.
As you listen to this conversation, Elaine Hagopian, last comments.
I think, first of all, everything that has been said is quite on target. I think it's very important to understand that if you just take this roadmap, for example, number one, I think that Ilan coming here really does kind of represent in some underhanded way Mr. Sharon. That was always his position in the past. Now, there are AIPAC and the Conference of American Jewish Presidents organizations who are backing an effort to block the roadmap. They don't say they're against the roadmap. They focus on the particular thing, the procedure that calls for concurrent and parallel steps to be taken. And what they are saying, and they have gathered 87 senators and 287 congressmen to send a letter to Bush saying you cannot put symmetry to these two parties because the Palestinians are the violent ones, the terrorists, and they must take actions first and cease all violence and cease all terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, stop the resistance. Now, this is really calling for something that is almost impossible for Palestinians to do. We know that Abu Mazen is weak. He cannot stop the violence because he really cannot promise anything from the roadmap that it's going to lead ultimately to a really viable state. Already, Bush's advisors are telling him not to push Sharon into making any kind of compromises that are involved in the procedures of this roadmap. There are not many concessions that are different from Oslo. As a matter of fact, they're somewhat worse. They're already telling him that if you want to get the conservative Jewish vote that supports Israel, this is not the way you're going to win them. And so they are focusing on his reelection, and therefore he has already said that he will not impose a solution on the parties, which means that Sharon and his government as the stronger party have free rein to do and set whatever conditions that they want.
Well, Elaine Hagopian, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Professor Emeritus of Simmons College in Boston. We've also been joined by Russell McIver of Corporate Crime Reporter and John Grebe. His piece, Reverend Pat Robertson and the Temple, appears at counterpunch.org. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Christian cannons have fired at my days with a warning beneath the holy blaze and bow to our authority, say the cannons of Christianity. Oh, the children will be sent to schools. Minds of clay are molded to the rules. Learn to fear all of eternity. Warn the cannons of Christianity. Holy hands will count the money raised. Like a king, the Lord is richly praised. On a cross of diamond majesty, say the canons of Christianity.
Canons of Christianity. Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. As we turn now to a conference that took place this weekend at the CUNY Grad Center in New York, that's the City University of New York, called American Spirit, Values, and Power, Resisting Empire, Affirming Our Vision. Among those who spoke was Leslie Kagan. She is co-chair of United for Peace and Justice, and she is also the chair of the Pacifica Foundation Board. This is an excerpt of what she had to say.
I think we really are at a pivotal moment. Of course, you know, as my introducer just said, who knows? History will tell when we look back at this moment how pivotal it has been, and more importantly, maybe what we've done with it, what we've done at this juncture in human history. I've been an activist, as you just heard, also an activist and social change organizer, peace and social change organizer, for about 37 years now, although I actually grew up in an activist family and recall the first demonstration that I remember being at was in the Bronx where I lived with my family, and there was a place where four or five different streets all crossed each other. I think it's called an intersection. And there was no traffic light there. There were a few stop signs, but no traffic light. And kids kept getting hit by cars. And the parents were quite upset and kept calling their city council people or, you know, appropriate people and getting no response. So one day the mothers in the neighborhood, my mother included, took a bunch of themselves and their kids and went out in the street, and we all held hands and, you know, literally blocked the intersection. Of course, it wasn't until many, many, many years later that I realized that not only was that one of my first demonstrations, it was actually an act of civil disobedience. So I feel privileged that I come from such a setting, such stock, if you will, where civil disobedience was not only an accepted activity, but actually encouraged. So I say that as sort of a backdrop to everything that we are thinking about and doing today. You know, perhaps we live in a time when more civil disobedience is required of us. And I do underscore the word civil here. I think there are many, many ways to be disobedient to the powers that be. I think our civility and our honesty and our courage are all part of what we bring to the table. Anyway, as an adult, it's been more like 37 years of organizing and activism. And I must say, while that's not a massive amount of time, although it feels like that sometimes to me, while it's not a massive amount of time, it's enough time for me to have some long view. I haven't been doing this for a week or a day or, you know, or even a year, but a long enough time to have some longer view. And it does actually feel like both the worst of times and the best of times. And I know I didn't say that, I didn't make that up, somebody else said it first. But it does actually feel on any given day like this is ridiculous. What are we doing? The powers that we're up against are so massive and so cruel and so mean-spirited and so powerful. What do we think we're doing? And then there are the other days where, and actually more of the other days, where I get up and say, okay, let's go. Precisely because things are so bad, how dare we sit back and not intervene and not inject ourselves in trying to turn things around. The good news is that there are massive numbers of people, not only in this city and in this country, but literally in every corner of the world, that have reached that point in their lives where they too are not sitting back, but have stepped up to the plate and said, we're going to do something. Just a word or two about the bad news, and I don't say this to bring us down or to assume that you don't already know this, but just to try and place the context here. Am I too loud or too soft? Hot mic. Okay. Is that better? No, that's too much. Okay, how's that? All right, just yell if you can't hear me. I love when speakers say that. If you can't hear me, raise your hand. Anyway, just to place some of this in a context, I don't want to, you know, sort of lay a bum rap on everybody about the bad news, but I do think we need to be honest in our assessment of the conditions that we're working in, that if we're not honest with each other, how are we going to, you know, figure out what it is that we need to do? And not only honest with each other, but honest with the people that we're trying to organize, the people that we seek to invite into this process with us. On virtually any single level of life, whether it's at the community level, on the city, or national, or international level, there are serious, serious, massive problems, massive things that are wrong. Of course, given the work I do these days, I'm most attuned to this incredible military machinery that has not only been built, but is actually being used by the powers that be in this country virtually every day in one way or another. They may not be dropping a bomb every single day, although pretty much every single day, but they may not be dropping bombs or rolling the Marines through the lands of other people, but they use militarism in all the different ways they can. You know, if you hold a gun to someone's head, you don't have to pull the trigger to be using that gun. You're still using it. And I think that analogy holds true for how they use the military. That the incursion into Iraq, the war, I don't even know if war is really the word, more like the assault against a mostly innocent population was as much a message to Saddam Hussein and the old rulers of that country as it was a message to people in every corner of the world that if you don't function, if you don't work the way we want you to work, we will send the Marines. Now, that message has been sent many, many times since the end of World War II, certainly, in many different ways. But this was yet another opportunity for them to say, not only will we use the military machinery we have, we have tremendous resources and every imaginable type of military advancement, if you can use that word, we have at our disposal. And it's not just that they have it, but again, there is this commitment at the highest level of this government to solve problems through militarism. You know, I remember when, I think it was at Columbine, I think it was after the Columbine shootings when Clinton was president, and he was like outraged that young people, you know, turned to violence. And I can't remember the exact words he used, but it was basically he was trying to say, you know, where do they get this idea from? Hello? Where do they get this idea from? And I think that this is, that the notion, the commitment to militarism is not just about a foreign policy. It's a commitment to violence and the use of force and militarism, obviously in different ways with different machinery available that runs throughout this culture. A number of years ago, the War Resisters League had started a campaign, and I don't actually know what happened to it, but a campaign to try and get rid of toy guns. The toys that little kids play with that teach them you know, about militarism in a very hands-on kind of way. And I do think we need to think about that.
Leslie Kagan, co-chair of the United for Peace and Justice Coalition, an excerpt of her speech this weekend in New York at a conference called American Spirit, Values, and Power. And that does it for today's program. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karam, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel and Vil Katsouris. Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby are light. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more be used from man? Can't you stand?
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A major leader of the anti-apartheid movement is dead. Walter Sisulu was 90 years old. He spent a quarter of a century imprisoned on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela. Today, we'll speak with the head of the South African National Assembly, Frenie Ginwala. The man who wrote the Book of Virtues, the former drug czar of the United States, Bill Bennett, has been exposed as a high-stakes gambler. He now says he'll do it no more. And we look at transcripts that have been released on the secret questioning by Senator Joseph McCarthy. Among those questioned, Aaron Copeland and Langston Hughes. All that and more coming up. Okay. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. officials gave the first details yesterday of their plan to set up an interim Iraqi government. It will likely be headed by a council of as many as 9 leaders, the majority of whom would be drawn from U.S.-backed Iraqi exile groups that have yet to demonstrate popular support in Iraq. The head administrator of U.S.-occupied Iraq, Lieutenant General Jay Garner, said the nucleus of the interim Iraqi government would be emerging by the end of the month. Garner named 5 figures who've already begun meeting. All were Kurdish or exile leaders who have long been backed and financed by the United States. They are Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress, Masoud Barzani of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, Jalal Talabani of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, Abdulaziz Hakim of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and Ayad Alawi of the Iraqi National Accord. The Washington Post reports Garner visited Basra for the first time. After Garner met with hospital officials, an Iraqi man trailed him, carrying a small boy of about 5 years old, with both legs in casts. Blood seeped from the foot of one cast as the man tried to attract Garner's attention. Garner, who was surrounded by bodyguards and aides, shook hands with the hospital director and, without appearing to notice the man, left to visit an oil refinery. The UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency, the IAEA, is urging Washington to allow it to investigate nuclear sites in Iraq that have reportedly been looted, but Washington has ignored the requests. The agency is concerned that radioactive material known to be stored at several Iraqi sites could pose health and environmental risks. There are also fears the waste could be used to create a so-called dirty bomb. Over the weekend, The Washington Post and New York Times ran articles indicating the U.S. had taken few measures to secure former nuclear sites. The Post reported at the Baghdad Nuclear Research Facility, Iraqis had been, quote, coming in by the score for the past 2 weeks. Radioactive material is scattered around the site. The U.S. is saying that it has captured Dr. Huda Salimadi Amash, one of Saddam Hussein's most senior biological weapons scientists. She is number 53 on the U.S. list of 55 most wanted Iraqi leaders. She was one of the few women in Saddam Hussein's inner circle. This news from Gaza. The parents of a British peace activist who was shot in the head by Israeli troops came under fire themselves as they traveled to the spot where their son was critically injured. The London Independent reports Anthony and Jocelyn Herndl were in a British diplomatic convoy entering the town of Rafah in the Gaza Strip when Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint fired a shot, which passed narrowly over the top of their vehicles. The Herndl's eldest son, Tom, is in a coma in an Israeli hospital after he was shot 3 weeks ago while trying to reach 2 Palestinian children. The U.S. military is preparing to release about 15 prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This includes as many as 3 boys, aged between 13 and 16 years old, who were captured in Afghanistan more than a year ago. They'd been held at Guantanamo for this time. The Washington Post reports the Pentagon plans to expedite decisions about whether to prosecute, continue interrogating, or release the more than 660 prisoners held at the detention facility. This comes after criticism from Secretary of State General Colin Powell. A mission by 3 Southern African leaders aimed at resolving the political crisis in Zimbabwe of President Robert Mugabe ended in dismal failure yesterday. This according to a report in the London Independent. South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki, the Nigerian leader President Obasanjo, and the Malawian President Bakili Muluzi jetted into Harare yesterday for meetings with President Mugabe in the hope this would lead to a deal for the 79-year-old Mugabe's retirement and the installation of a new president from Mugabe's ZANU-PF party. The talks also included a representative from an opposition party that is challenging Zimbabwe's last election. Mugabe rejected any talks of stepping down until the opposition drops its lawsuits and recognizes him as Zimbabwe's official leader. The University of California, Berkeley, will turn away new students from China, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong this summer in what is believed to be the first such move by a major university to prevent the spread of SARS. Meanwhile, in China, 10,000 people have been quarantined in the eastern city of Nanjing. In China, SARS has claimed 214 lives and infected more than 4,400 people. Newly released transcripts indicate Senator Joseph McCarthy used closed-door secret sessions to winnow out witnesses who might have challenged him in the sensational anti-communism trials of the 1950s. Of the 500 witnesses who testified in private, one-third were never called back to testify in public. Among those who testified in private were the composer Aaron Copland, poet Langston Hughes, mystery writer Dashiell Hammett. Copland fiercely defended himself, saying, "I have not been a communist in the past, and I am not now a communist." Hughes protested that he had not read much about Marxism, quote, beyond the introduction of the Communist Manifesto. Hammett invoked the Fifth Amendment. McCarthy was a Wisconsin Republican. He led the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in 1953 and 1954, at the height of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. His investigation into communists and the U.S. government was widely seen as a witch hunt and spawned the term McCarthyism to describe smear attacks. We'll have more on that story later in the program. Congress may soon pass a controversial new law that would shield gun manufacturers and dealers from lawsuits filed by victims of gun crimes. The bill has been the focus of a major lobbying push by the NRA and a lesser-known organization called the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which has raised $100 million over the past 5 years from gun makers to fight lawsuits and fund its national political campaign. A recent article in the Washington Post quotes a top aide to a Senate Democrat who calls the bill the, quote, "things you've got to do to get reelected" act. A Colombian provincial governor, a former defense minister, and 8 military personnel were killed in a failed rescue attempt near the northern Colombian town of Urao on Monday. They were among the 80 hostages the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, have been holding to negotiate the release of political prisoners. The Colombian government immediately blamed the rebels for the murders, which were described as execution-style killings. But a FARC spokesperson read a communique on local radio blaming the deaths on a botched rescue attempt by government forces. In the Philippines, the government has called off talks with the main Muslim separatist group, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. This comes 2 days after about 30 people died in an attack by the group. And finally, a veteran of South Africa's anti-apartheid movement died last night. Walter Sisulu was 90 years old. He spent a quarter of a century in jail alongside his close friend, Nelson Mandela. They were both sentenced to life in 1964 for plotting sabotage and revolution, and detained on Robben Island until the apartheid regime finally relented and released him in 1989. We'll have more on that story in a minute. Baba
abantwana bamali mama uyibula abantwana abancane bakankulunkulu uyibula abantwana abancane bahlale ethempelini mama uyizole zizingane zikankulunkulu usiyababona abantwana abancane abahlala ethempelini bo uyiba abantwana mama house nabantwana mamauyibobaabahlala ethempelini usizi
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. One of the leaders of the movement against apartheid in South Africa has died. Walter Sisulu passed away last night. He died 2 weeks before his 91st birthday. He spent a quarter of a century in prison for his organizing against the apartheid regime. Walter Maxwell Yate Sisulu was born in the Eastern Cape. His mother, Alice Sisulu, was a black domestic worker. His father, Victor Dickinson, was a white assistant magistrate. The first time Walter Sisulu ever saw a train was when he rode one that took rural recruits to work at the Rose Deep Mine. Sisulu also worked as a domestic worker, paint mixer, advertising agent, and newspaper columnist. His family was forcibly removed from their home in Doornfontein to the New Orlando Township in 1934. Hundreds of thousands of black South Africans were forcibly removed from their homes and forced into teeming townships during the apartheid era. In 1944, Sisulu, Nelson Mandela, and Oliver Tambo founded the African National Congress Youth League. The Youth League revolutionized the ANC, transforming it from a minor political party into a mass-based liberation movement. Sisulu was the organizing genius behind the ANC's major political protests in the 1950s. He eventually entered the armed wing of the ANC, Umkhonto weSizwe, or Spear of the Nation. He was arrested 6 times in 1962, and after going underground a year later, was arrested in July of 1963. The white apartheid regime sentenced Sisulu to life in prison for plotting sabotage and revolution. He was imprisoned on Robben Island with his close friend Nelson Mandela for a quarter of a century. Walter Sisulu was released in 1989 at the age of 77 as the mass popular movement forced the apartheid regime to begin negotiating a transfer of power. He immediately resumed his organizing. He was elected deputy president of the African National Congress in 1991 and was part of the ANC team that negotiated with the ruling National Party. South Africa's first democratic election was held in April 1994. We turn now to Dr. Frenny Ginwala. She is Speaker of the South African National Assembly. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you start off by reflecting on the life of Walter Sisulu?
Yes. Well, he was so much a part of the ANC and of struggle in South Africa. It's very difficult to imagine things going on without him. And yet he bequeathed us with a kind of spirit and a kind of tradition that meant people will continue. He epitomized in his life his commitment, his determination, his courage, as well as his kindness and, of course, his sense of humor, that he epitomized everything we aspired to as a society and as a people. Hello.
Frenny Ginwala, can you talk about your own personal experience with Walter Sisulu? Can you talk about the phone call you received in 1960? This was long ago, long before the quarter of a century that he spent in prison.
That's right. Well, he changed my life. I had known him as a student activist, and he taught me a lot about the nature of the ANC. But out of the blue, I didn't know him very well. I mean, he was one of our great leaders, and I was just a student. When he asked me to arrange for Oliver Tambo, the then deputy president, to leave the country. And of course, I suppose it's the ignorance of youth. I blithely agreed, not knowing what I was letting myself in for, and left the country to make the arrangements. Then Sharpeville happened, and Oliver Tambo did come out. We got him out of the country. And 31 years later, when I met Walter Sisulu, I asked him, I said, why me? Why did you ask me to do this? And he just looked at me and he said, well, I thought you could do it. And I think that was typical of him. He was surprised that I should even ask, because I think his attitude was, all of us did, and he did what we were asked. We were part of the struggle. And you therefore continued in that way. That was his life anyway.
Right now, the reaction in South Africa to the death of Walter Sisulu, 2 weeks shy of his 91st birthday.
Well, of course, there's a great sense of loss, a lot of grief, a lot of concern for Mama Sisulu, for Albertina Sisulu. They were exceptionally close. They were fortunate, though of course divided by 26 years when he was imprisoned, but they were always close. I know when, after 94, Albertina came into Parliament, Walter would come in and sit in the public gallery, especially if she was going to speak, or if any of his children, because two of his children were also in Parliament in those years. And that sense of family, and I think there is a lot of concern and love and empathy for her, because much as we may feel, we can imagine just what her own feelings are.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll return with the Speaker of the South African National Assembly, Frenny Jinwala. Stay with us.
Silubonile no sizolwa bezizwe sithi enkosi enkosi siyabonga siyabonga ngalebuha enkosi bantabo mntanami ibonakele imisebenzi yenu sibabonile bethu nami ngabe kithisela June 16, 1976.
I'm sad.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Our guest is Dr. Frenny Jinwala. She is the Speaker of the South African National Assembly and co-chair of the Global Coalition on Africa, a member of the ANC National Executive, a longtime activist for the African National Congress and women's rights. In 1960, she left South Africa to arrange the escape of the late Oliver Tambo, the president of the ANC, and to help establish the ANC office in exile. Dr. Jinwala became head of the political research unit in the office of President Tambo and was known for her research on South Africa's nuclear program, sanctions, and the arms and oil embargo. She joins us on the telephone talking about Walter Sisulu, who last night died 2 weeks before he turned 91 years old, spent a quarter of a century in prison under the apartheid regime, had spent his whole life fighting it, spent his time in jail alongside Nelson Mandela. Dr. Frenny Jinwala, can you talk about those years, what it meant for Walter Sisulu and Nelson Mandela to be imprisoned? How pivotal that time was on Robben Island.
Well, of course, they were at one level cut off from us, but they still inspired whatever was happening. And after the first few years, we were able to communicate. And gradually, they were giving leadership from even where they were. But I think it was their inspiration that, if you like, was the fuel for the activism and the organization that continued until such time, eventually, there was sufficient pressure in the 1980s on the apartheid regime to force them to release first Walter Sisulu and then 2 years later, Nelson Mandela. And very, very typically, of course, no sooner had Walter come out of prison than he was back at something he excelled in, and that was organizing. And he began organizing the internal leadership of the ANC in preparation for its unbanning.
What about his force? What about his relationship with Nelson Mandela right through the period of Mandela's presidency, the president of South Africa? How much power did Walter Sisulu wield, as well as his wife, Albertina Sisulu?
I think it's not a sense of a formal power. He was a member of the ANC. He was deputy president of the ANC. While we were still negotiating, and when we first went into government, and when President Mandela became president. But the way he influenced things wasn't an exercise of formal power. It was his wisdom, his ready availability to give advice, his strategic vision, because he was always the person who tended to see through you might call a sort of veritable net of counter forces and so on, and to get to the point. And prison didn't seem to have dimmed that in any way. During the negotiations, just before the elections, early in the morning, he was in his 70s, 80s by then, he would be there at 6:30 in the morning when the negotiations team met to look at it, and he was always incisive, getting to the point, clearing the way and saying, look, those things are irrelevant. This is the sticking point. This is what we must insist on. So his style of leadership, his style of exercise of power was one of giving advice, being there, and I think came from those who saw and had great respect for his vision and his understanding, including Mr. Mandela.
Dr. Frenny Janwala, you fought very hard to ensure women's rights in the South African Constitution, perhaps the most progressive constitution when it comes to women's rights in the world. Can you talk about Walter Sisulu's response to that effort?
Well, he was a Democrat with, by instinct, if I can put it that way. And I don't think it ever occurred to him that women should be anything less than equal. In his own life, in his own family, women played their roles not simply as sort of supporters, but Albertina, his wife, was an activist. Before they got married, she continued in the struggle. His children did the same thing. His daughter, who's now the Minister of Intelligence, was part of it. And at no point did he distinguish that these were women and therefore, one, they should not be involved or they should be less than equal. I think that's what I mean when I say he was a Democrat by instinct. He took it for granted. Of course, he encouraged his children. He encouraged all of us. Well, I knew him as a very young student, and I don't think he made those kinds of distinctions between young students who were male or female. And he worked for equality for all people. He was concerned very much about the poor. And therefore, by the very nature of South African society, women were amongst the poorest. So they were amongst his greatest concern. He was concerned about workers. And once again, it was those in formal employment as well as those in informal employment. And that brought women within his overall vision as well.
Dr. Frenny Jhunjhwala, I wanted to ask for a moment if we could switch subjects and look at what's happening right now in Zimbabwe. President Robert Mugabe, coming under concerted pressure from three African leaders, including President of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, to begin negotiations with the opposition party. The information coming out in the United States is that George Bush, Tony Blair, Prime Minister of Britain, are pushing once again for regime change, this now in Zimbabwe. And so now we see Presidents Thabo Mbeki, the Nigerian President Obasanjo, Malawian President Bikile Mzuzi going to Harare yesterday to encourage talks and basically, it sounds like, for the stepping down of Robert Mugabe. I'm looking at a piece in The Guardian that says, after meeting with Mugabe, the leaders met with Morgan Tsvangirai, head of the opposition, for 90 minutes. Who said, the three presidents agreed with me that Zimbabwe is in a dire state. We agreed we have to work out a solution. And then the article goes on to say that Mugabe has not welcomed the pressure from his fellow African leaders. The state-owned Sunday Mail newspaper questioned whether the presidents were coming, quote, as African brothers or as agents of the British government. Can you comment on the role of South Africa in the attempt to basically push out of office Robert Mugabe?
No, I think it would be totally incorrect to see South Africa or the role of any of the other two leaders who were with President Mbeki as engaged in an exercise in regime change. Very much on the contrary. Our position has been all along, and it remains so, that the solution lies in bringing the two sides in Zimbabwe together, which means getting talks going between President Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai and, of course, their parties, because they're the only ones who can resolve it. Now, one of the things that did come through, and I'm now going by media reports, obviously, but also from an understanding of the situation, what did come through is for the first time, I believe, Morgan Tsvangirai said he was prepared to talk to Robert Mugabe as president of the country. Now, President Mugabe was still saying that the court challenge must be abandoned because the opposition parties are challenging the elections. But both sides have been engaged in court battles because Morgan Tsvangirai is also being charged with treason. But whether those cases are to be dropped or to be pursued simultaneously with talks, the South African and the African president's position would be they've got to resolve it amongst themselves. Certainly, there would be agreement that the situation in Zimbabwe is very poor, dire was, I think, the quotation you used, and we would agree with it. There are very serious problems, very serious hardships that ordinary people are facing. And this adds to the pressure for trying to resolve the differences. But I think this attempt, and this is what was important, that by talking to both sides and saying, come together, pushing them to see if there was a way of getting them to talk to each other, would be South Africa's major pressure. Earlier last year, we had the Secretary General of the African National Congress spending weeks in Zimbabwe trying to achieve exactly that, to try to persuade both sides to talk. We do not believe that change will come from outside. It can influence change. It can facilitate change. But it can't solve the problems which have to be done by Zimbabwe.
Do you think there's any relation to what's going on in Zimbabwe, scuttling international support for NEPAD, which is the New Economic Partnership for African Development, that Thabo Mbeki has very much supported, is very controversial, and is very much supported by the international financial institutions, the U.S. government? Do you support it?
Well, yes, we support NEPAD. I mean, we're part of it. But the fact that one country or anyone outside feels there's a problem with one country, we don't see why that should affect their relationship with the rest of the continent. I mean, there have been problems in Europe, in Yugoslavia, for example. That didn't affect relationships with the rest of Europe any more than problems on the in North America or whatever difficulties are there should affect it. So we don't think that you can sort of say that unless this is so, we will not support you, because we're assuming the support is genuine, the support is genuine concern, not about one country or not about saying you can only solve it in this way. The way the NEPAD program functions is that countries will have to comply with particular criteria before they benefit from programs. So in a way, countries in Africa have a choice and countries outside Africa have a choice, because the criteria are there for all to support.
Finally, Dr. Frenny Ginwala, Speaker of the South African National Assembly, as we talk about issues of regime change, it takes us to Iraq and the U.S. invasion. Your stance on the invasion and what should happen at this point?
Well, I personally feel that we have moved backwards by virtue of the invasion. Not so much the invasion as such, but by the abandonment of multilateralism. We spent a lot of 50 years building up a world that recognized interdependence, recognized multilateralism, built up institutions. And it is very sad that one power, which has the power, should just decide no, they will ignore that. In other words, if the world and the UN doesn't agree with them, they still will go ahead and invade another country. That, I believe, has set us back. We now clearly need to rebuild multilateralism in Iraq as well as elsewhere. So we really need to go back to the United Nations. United Nations is not perfect, but you don't abandon something, because what do you have in its place? The unilateral exercise of power is not acceptable to the rest of the world. We may have to put up with it because the United States is very powerful. That doesn't mean we accept it or support it. We believe we need to come back to a multilateral world, and the solution, the long-term solution to Iraq, must lie with multilateral institutions, with all countries coming together to help the Iraqi people and to move them forward, to help them, their economy move forward.
Dr. Frenny Ginwala, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Speaker of the South African National Assembly. Thank you. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we talk to an issue here at home. Some are calling him the bookie of virtue. William Bennett made millions lecturing people on morality, now blowing it on gambling. He served as Secretary of Education and Chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities under President Ronald Reagan. He was Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy under President George Bush. He is the co-chair of the National Commission on Civic Renewal and the Partnership of a Drug-Free America, author and editor of 14 books, including the best-selling book, The Book of Virtues. His most recent project is Americans for Victory Over Terrorism, and he has recently written a new book called Why We Fight, Moral Clarity and the War on Terrorism. He's William Bennett. He plays low-stakes poker with a group of prominent conservatives, including Robert Bork, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, and Chief Justice William Rehnquist. But according to reports in two magazines last week, Bill Bennett also plays poker for high stakes. He's gambled and lost more than $8 million in casinos in Atlantic City to Las Vegas. The article in the Washington Monthly is headlined Bookie of Virtues. The headline in Newsweek asks a question, virtue is as virtue does. Those breaking stories generated further unflattering headlines around the world. The Ottawa Citizen reports, anti-drug crusader can't say no to gambling, and the Guardian of London blares, voice of morality exposed as chronic casino loser. In a statement released yesterday after the exposés came out, William Bennett said, quote, "A number of stories in the media have reported I've engaged in high-stakes gambling over the past decade. It's true I've gambled large sums of money. I've also complied with all laws on reporting wins and losses. Nevertheless, I've done too much gambling, and this is not an example I wish to set. Therefore, my gambling days are over." We're joined now by Joshua Green, editor of the Washington Monthly and author of the piece, Bookie of Virtues. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be with you.
Well, what do you think of Bill Bennett's statement yesterday?
Well, I think it was probably a wise move politically, and I think it was probably a good move for his family and everyone involved, really. I mean, the casino records we obtained just showed monumental losses, you know, over the course of the last decade. And this from someone who's really made his life and made his role as a public figure, you know, encouraging other folks to be virtuous. And he's usually first in line to criticize anyone who isn't.
Why does this matter? Is this a matter of what he personally does? Why make it public?
Well, I think it's different. I think it's difficult to be the sort of the self-appointed moral czar and pretend that your own actions aren't important or don't have any bearing on what you do. I mean, as Mr. Bennett is the first to say, he's become a very rich man. Speaking and writing books about the importance of controlling one's appetite and personal responsibility and virtues. And I think just about everyone who heard this story, you know, understood immediately there was a disconnect between, you know, that kind of sermonizing and Bennett's behavior in the casinos.
How did you discover this story, Joshua Green?
Well, I mean, this has been an open secret among conservatives in Washington for some time. I think only recently did some of them begin to understand the extent of his gambling losses. And there was also, I think there's quite a bit of animosity among casino industry workers, because Bennett's organization, the one that he co-founded, Empower America, is officially opposed to the expansion of casino gambling. So there was a you know, an obvious sort of hypocrisy there, I think, on the part of or seen from the point of view of a lot of casino workers. Of, you know, here's a guy who during the day is opposed to casinos, but you know, spends the wee hour of the morning, you know, pumping coins into a slot machine.
We're also joined on the line by someone you talk about in your piece, Tom Gray, executive director of the National Coalition Against Gambling Expansion in Rockford, Illinois. Tom Gray, what is your response to this story?
Well, I think it's a personal tragedy, and I think it points to something larger in the sense that this is a hidden addiction. It's even hidden from him. And I'm encouraged by the fact that he has said that he's not going to do this. My sense is that he's going to have help not to do this. You don't move from the type of high-level addiction that he was in and all of a sudden turn it off. The experience is that it's very difficult to stop this. But it's a hidden addiction in terms of the society, because Bill Bennett did not attack gambling. It was noticeable to us that he was largely silent on this issue. And we were trying to make a case that here's a person that was hard on drug, alcohol, and yet spoke virtually nothing about gambling, and he could have played a larger role. So our hope is at this point that perhaps this is a case. There are 5.5 million people with pathological problem gambling in the United States, and we think that that's a low estimate.
Can you talk about gambling as big business in this country? I mean, you have people like Frank Fahrenkopf, who were formerly head of the Republican Party, who then became the head of the whole gaming lobby in this country.
Yeah, I think what you have is the nation's on a gambling binge. I mean, we have states that are casino junkies. They are gambling the future of their budgets. Nevada's $700 million with a budget deficit this year. And if you could gamble yourself rich, Nevada would certainly be this. I think another tragedy with William Bennett, he probably should have stayed with low-stakes poker with the Supreme Court justices, but he was playing machines in the casinos. He was not James Bond with a blonde on his arm walking up to a poker table and playing a game of skill. You can have the IQ of a canned ham. That's the learning curve on playing these machines. The danger is that the casino people are now marketing a highly addictive delivery system of addiction, and that is the machines. They're even coinless now, where any sense of reality that you're gambling millions of dollars is lost by the fact that you're touching a screen and you're seeing credits appear. And I think this is the danger that America faces, that we've got on Main Street now throughout America machines that are somewhat like the invasion of the body snatchers. They take a person like Bill Bennett, who lives a very high moral, speaks of the life, and then he gets hooked up to the machine, and he is a slot machine, a serial junkie.
Joshua Green, you write about Bennett's organization, Empower America, opposing the extension of casino gambling in states, and how Jack Kemp, co-chair of Empower America, inveighed against lawmakers who, quote, pollute our society with a slot machine on every corner. And in an introduction written by Bennett, reports 5.5 million American adults as problem or pathological gamblers. Bennett says he's neither, because his habit does not disrupt his family life. He could become a very powerful spokesperson against gambling if he, in fact, can stay away from it.
The first things I noticed when reporting this story, you know, I went and bought a stack of his books. And, you know, Bennett speaks about everything from, adultery to divorce to child abuse to wife swapping. I mean, it was just, once you start looking for him to talk about gambling, it was really a glaring omission in a lot of his books. And I do think that Reverend Gray is absolutely right that, I mean, here is a man who has really had an impact on public policy as far as, you know, influencing candidates and people at all levels. To listen to what he's saying. I mean, his Book of Virtues was a bestseller. It certainly has a lot of good things to offer. And it's sort of dismaying to think that he could have been doing some good on gambling, but chose not to.
Final comments, Tom Gray.
Well, I think that, unfortunately, he's still in denial, because if you look at the criterion for pathological gambling, preoccupation, well, he was preoccupied. He risks significant relationships. I mean, his credibility, what more could a person have than the credibility of a position when you seek as a public person to try to elevate Americans' character and conduct? Chasing, losing money gambling returns another day in order to get even, escape, gambling a way of escaping from problems. So I would hope that he would recognize and maybe join us. We really are in an uphill battle. The Frank Fahrenkopf's, the million-dollar man, and their $6 million budget in Washington influencing the political process. And certainly Bill Bennett would be welcome, but I think he needs to say, this is a personal problem that now is an American problem, and I want to speak on it.
Well, Tom Gray and Joshua Green, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and end with the sentence Joshua Green begins with in his piece in the Washington Monthly, The Bookie of Virtue, quoting William Bennett. We should know that too much of anything, even a good thing, may prove to be our undoing. We need to set definite boundaries on our appetites. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go back to the McCarthy era and look at the hearings that people didn't know about in this country, the secret hearings of Joe McCarthy that included people like Aaron Copland and Langston Hughes. Stay with us.
Now every gambler knows the secret to surviving is knowing what to throw away, knowing what to keep, 'cause every hand's a winner and every hand's a loser, and the best you can hope for is to die in your sleep. So when he'd finished speaking, he turned back toward the window, crushed out his cigarette, and faded off to sleep. Then somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run.
The Gambler, Kenny Rogers here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newly released transcripts indicate that Senator Joseph McCarthy used closed-door secret sessions to winnow out witnesses who might have challenged him in the sensational anti-communist hearings more than a half a century ago. Of the 500 witnesses who testified in private, one-third were never called back to testify in public. Among those who testified in private were the composer Aaron Copland, poet Langston Hughes, and mystery writer Dashiell Hammett. Copland fiercely defended himself, saying, quote, "I've not been a communist in the past, and I'm not now a communist." Langston Hughes protested he had not read much about Marxism, quote, "beyond the introduction to the Communist Manifesto." Dashiell Hammett invoked the Fifth Amendment. McCarthy was a Wisconsin Republican. He headed up the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in 1953 and 1954 at the height of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. His investigation into communists in the U.S. government was widely seen as a witch hunt and spawned the term McCarthyism to describe smear attacks. We're joined on the telephone right now by Donald Ritchie. He is associate Senate historian. He edited the hearings into the five volumes that were retrieved from stenographic notes on 9,675 pages of onion skin typing paper and housed for more than half a century in the National Archives. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Donald Ritchie. So can you talk more about these documents that have just been released?
Well, they're very interesting documents. They're insights into what was going on behind closed doors. We knew what Senator McCarthy was telling to reporters. He would step outside after these hearings, and he would give his version of what had happened, and that would determine what the headlines would be the next day. He was making sensational charges of spy rings and subversion and espionage, but now we're seeing what kind of information he was actually getting from the witnesses, how he had twisted, in a sense, the stories that they were telling, how little he knew about many of the people that were testifying before him, and also the tactics that he was using that ranged from occasionally being solicitous of the witnesses to bombarding them with questions and bullying them into trying to make contradictory remarks or to make incriminating remarks.
Can you talk about some of the people that it was not known before had testified in private because they were never called back, perhaps because McCarthy felt that they were, as you said, standing up to him?
There's a range of people. He started out investigating the State Department, which was one of his longtime interests, and he was essentially talking to high-level bureaucrats at that stage, and that's a traditional type of person who might testify before a congressional investigation. Then he switched over to an investigation of the U.S. information libraries abroad. And while he was supposed to be investigating the government, he called a lot of witnesses who were not government employees. And you mentioned Langston Hughes and Dashiell Hammett and Aaron Copland. Well, they were there either because they had written a book that turned up on the shelves of one of these information libraries, or because they had gotten a Fulbright fellowship or some other government stipend to go abroad at some point. So anyone who, for any reason, had accepted funds from the government or had a book that was being promoted in a government library could be called up and then interrogated about their political beliefs. But then as the investigations continued, he began looking into really lower-level employees in the government, in civilian positions and also in the Army, people who were had never been called up before a congressional committee, were frightened to death, really, and often had no chance to get a counsel going in there, really couldn't defend themselves in many ways. The type of people he tended to call into the public hearings were those who either were going to kowtow to him or those who were going to stonewall him, who were going to absolutely refuse to answer questions, take the Fifth Amendment. He interpreted taking the Fifth Amendment as an admission of guilt, and he used that to prove to, supposedly, to the press and to the public that he had indeed found dangerous subversives in the government. And those are the people he brought up into the public sessions. But the many of the people who were not called up either were so mistaken in their in the identity of the individual when they were called in, or had nothing that contributed in any way to the larger story, or defended themselves very well, stood up to him in the closed hearings, and they just weren't the kind of people that he wanted to tackle in a public hearing.
Can you talk about G. David Shine?
Hmm. Yes, there's an interesting side to all of this, and that is that McCarthy hired a young assistant counsel. Chief counsel was Roy Cohn, who was 26 years old, who had been a prosecutor in the Rosenberg case and then who came down to work in Washington in the Truman Department, Justice Department, and then in 1953 was hired onto the committee. When Cohn arrived, he brought along his best friend, G. David Shine, who was essentially a rich kid. He was also 26 years old. He was the son of a family that owned major hotels in across the country. He was gone to Harvard. He drove a convertible with a car phone in 1953 to give you some idea of. This was an extremely wealthy family, had a suite at the Waldorf Astoria, and he came down with Cohn as the unpaid chief consultant to the committee. And it was really Cohn and Shine who gave McCarthy his big black eye for these hearings. In the spring of 1953, the two of them go to Europe to search out communist literature in the shelves of the U.S. information libraries. And, of course, the European press, when they hear about these two, they just eat them alive. They rip into them at press conferences. They make fun of them in headlines. It's not the kind of treatment that Roy Cohn expected to get. He comes back really irritated about this and takes on a lot of the high-ranking officials in the U.S. Information Agency, several of whom lose their jobs as a result of all of this. Shine is still there through the fall of 1953, and he gets drafted. He's a young man who hasn't served in the military, and there's universal draft at the time. And he's called into the Army as a private. And he immediately begins to ask his friend Roy Cohn to get him special privileges, weekend passes from Fort Dix, get him assigned back to the committee, get him out of doing basic training, get him out of doing KP, get him out of doing guard duty. And Roy Cohn is calling the Secretary of the Army to get special privileges for this private in basic training. The trouble was that at the exact same time, McCarthy was investigating the Army. And eventually, the Army compiled a list of all the special favors that Cohn was asking for. And when McCarthy went too far in verbally abusing decorated officers who were testifying before him, the Army then released this list and said, look, on one hand, McCarthy is attacking our offices. On the other hand, he's demanding special privileges for this private. McCarthy responded, as he usually did, by attacking his opponents, and he accused the Army of holding Private Shine as a hostage to try to derail his investigation. And that forced him to step down as the chairman of the subcommittee so that his own subcommittee could investigate his own charges. And that's what set up the famous Army McCarthy hearings in 1954, which were televised. Those were open public hearings. There were some closed hearings associated with that we have published in these volumes, and we now see a little bit more about what was going on then. But Shine is really the trigger for all of this. And ultimately, everybody is destroyed in this except for David Shine. Roy Cohn, who expected to have a political career, never holds office as a result of this. He's always going to be linked to Joe McCarthy. McCarthy is censured by the Senate, and he's politically ruined as a result of this. But David Shine goes on sort of blithely to Hollywood and becomes a Hollywood producer. He eventually was the producer of the movie The French Connection, wins the Academy Award, and lived a very glamorous life on the West Coast, I think fairly oblivious to the chaos that he caused back in Washington.
Donald Ritchie, what about the memorable moments with the authors who came under attack, people like Langston Hughes and Paul Robeson's wife, Aslanda Good Robeson?
Yes. I think the single most eloquent testimony in closed-door session was Langston Hughes's testimony. And probably the only reason he was able to give that testimony was that Senator McCarthy was absent from the hearing that day. And Everett Dirksen, senator from Illinois, was presiding. And Dirksen acted more the way a traditional senator would act, and that is he gave the witness a chance to express himself. Roy Cohn's tactic was to be a sort of a prosecutor, to interrupt the witnesses, to demand yes or no answers, not to allow them to make statements, not to allow them to explain themselves. He was trying to build a case against them. Senator Dirksen felt that if you called a witness, you ought to be able to hear what the witness had to say. And so he stops Cohn, and he allows Langston Hughes to speak. And Hughes gives this terrific autobiographical account of growing up as a poor young African-American in segregated America and why, in the depths of the Depression, he was attracted to radical politics and how he went to the Soviet Union with a film crew and how disillusioned he was by what he saw in the Soviet Union and how he had really changed his worldview as a result of all of that, and that his thinking in the 1950s was not the same as his thinking was in the early 1930s. It's a terrific explanation. I think many of the other witnesses might have been able to say that if they'd been given a chance. When Langston Hughes testifies in public, he tries to say this again, but McCarthy cuts him off, and so his public testimony isn't anywhere near as revealing as his closed-door session testimony was. Mrs. Robeson, on the other hand, she was there just because she'd written a biography of her husband that happened to be on a shelf in a U.S. information library. She wasn't about to give any explanations to Joe McCarthy. She just, resisted. She wouldn't answer any of his questions. She took the Fifth Amendment. She also cited the 15th Amendment, and McCarthy was furious about that. But, of course, she didn't hold a federal job, and she wasn't about to cooperate with this committee, and there was nothing that McCarthy could do to punish her in any way.
She said, "I'm a second-class citizen in this country and therefore feel the need of the 15th. That's the reason
right.
I use it. I'm not quite equal to the rest of white people." And Langston Hughes, when told to shorten his responses, said, "I would much rather preserve my reputation and freedom than to save time." Donald Ritchie, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Associate Senate Historian. Thank you. And that does it for the program. We're going to link our website to the thousands of pages that have just been released from the McCarthy hearings. You can go to democracynow.org. We also video and audio stream the full expanded 2 hours of Democracy Now! And that does it for the program. Again, our website, democracynow.org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. You can get a copy, video, or audio of today's show, 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel, Vilka Suras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Turn back toward the window, crushed out.